This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the weekend, a hardline cleric was named the head of the newly powerful Islamic Courts Union in Somalia. Sheikh Hassan Dahir Awais, a former colonel in the Somali army, is on a U.S. list of suspected terrorists, and the U.N. suspects that he belongs to or is associated with al-Qaeda. He denies it. Over the last several years, he did help build an Islamic militia in Somalia under the authority of the Council of Islamic Courts. 3 weeks ago, the Islamic militia defeated a coalition of warlords backed by the United States and promised to bring order and establish Sharia law in a country that's often described as the definition of a failed state. There's been no government in Somalia for more than 15 years now. Violence and unemployment are pervasive. Foreign journalists and aid workers face very real dangers there, so it's not easy to figure out what's going on. The new leadership in Mogadishu prompts Washington to worry about a new Taliban in the Horn of Africa that could provide a new base of operations and training grounds for al-Qaeda. But is the Council of the Islamic Courts as radical as feared or as moderate as it makes itself out to be? There is a government recognized by the UN. There's a breakaway province in the north of the country. The warlords are said to be regrouping, and Somalia's neighbors support various factions inside the country. The situation has changed and may well change again. If you have questions about what's going on in Somalia, what we actually know about it, about regional interests, or how U.S. policy ought to adapt, our number is 800-989-8255. Excuse me, that's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Our first guest is Rob Crilly, a freelance reporter and contributor to the Christian Science Monitor and to the Times of London. He joins us by phone from his home in Nairobi. Nice to have you on the program today. Excuse me, Mr. Crilly. Mr. Crilly, can you hear me? Rob Crilly, are you there? Well, apparently we're having some difficulties with the phone line to Nairobi. We'll get back to Rob Crilly as soon as we can. In the meantime, we're going to Uppsala in Sweden. Ken Menkhouse is Associate Professor of Political Science at Davidson College in North Carolina, an expert on Somalia, but he's with us from Uppsala in Sweden, where he's on sabbatical. Nice to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
And now that Sheikh Awais heads the courts, what is his position? As I understand it, the court said to the UN-recognized government, we recognize you, we don't want to be the government.
His position is intentionally ill-defined. Right now, what the Islamists are doing in Mogadishu are trying to play a dual game, presenting moderate leadership in the executive board of this, and then Awais as head of a legislative body, and we don't even know what that legislative body is going to do next. So the situation is extremely unclear, both in terms of the emerging relationship between the council and the transitional government, and Awais's ultimate place. What we do know is that he has been the real power behind the Islamist movement in Mogadishu over the past couple of years. So the formalization of his position now should not come as a surprise. It is provocative in the sense that by formalizing his role, he runs the risk of ending dialogue with the TFG. He runs the risk of provoking Ethiopia and he's already earned the State Department's decision not to speak with him.
And the next step, though, how well established is this new Islamic force in Mogadishu and indeed throughout the country?
The local Islamic Sharia courts that form the backbone of this umbrella group are very well established. They are very much part of a grassroots attempt to provide a semblance of law and order at the local level, at the clan level. In Somalia, and they're not going to go anywhere anytime soon. As for the fate of the broader and more overtly political umbrella movement, that is much less clear. They have claimed that they would like to establish an administration across not only Mogadishu, but all of the hinterland around Mogadishu and up into central Somalia that they control. This is land that's almost exclusively under the control of one clan, the Hawiya clan. And that raises one of the first issues, is this Islamist movement going to be able to break beyond a lineage identity that it currently has?
And that raises questions, too, about the UN-recognized government, always described as weak, that is currently in Baidoa, a provincial town in Somalia.
this has been one of the problems for the transitional federal government. It was established after a two-year process of negotiations in Nairobi. It was supposed to constitute a government of national unity, but what happened, in fact, is it has become a fairly narrow coalition. And it has alienated most of the population in Mogadishu. And that's why it hasn't been able to set foot there, so that the leadership decided to establish this temporary capital in a small town of Baidoa. I was there just a few weeks ago. They don't even control Baidoa. The streets are completely lawless. There are freelance militia running around. It's an accident waiting to happen. So this is a government that it's generous to call it weak at this time.
And its president, as I understand it, has a longstanding rivalry with Sheikh Awais, the head of the Islamic courts.
That's correct. And those two really reflect part of a broader trend. For a number of years, for all of the shifting alliances that we've seen in Somalia that can just drive you crazy if you're keeping score, a few things have stayed constant, and that is there's been a core group of Ethiopian-backed Somalis, not entirely, but mainly from one clan family, the Darod, facing opposition from a Mogadishu-centered a group of opponents that have as their core support a Hawiya clan. And that has not changed. The Islamist flavor that we're seeing now out of Mogadishu is new. But the battle lines have not changed really in the past 6 years.
And I think we have Rob Crilly back with us on the line from Nairobi. Are you there?
Yeah, hi. Good to be with you at last.
Thanks very much. Nice to speak with you. And tell us, you were in Mogadishu just a couple of weeks ago. Is the situation there as chaotic as it sounds?
Well, no, actually, it's not as chaotic as it's been there for some time. The fact that I was visiting at all only really came about because with the city now in the hands of the Islamic courts, there's a degree of stability and security that we haven't seen there for a while. The courts have managed to set up a very limited degree of law and order there, which has meant that a lot of people have been able to return to the streets. People are walking around at night. They're walking around unhindered by the checkpoints that crisscross the city up till a few weeks ago. Now, of course, it's Mogadishu, so the sort of security that I'm talking about is nothing like what we in the West would be used to. And, of course, there was a Swedish cameraman who was shot dead there on Friday as a testament to the fact that Mogadishu remains a very dangerous place. But actually, having been to Baidoa as well just a week earlier, I was surprised by the level of organization that appears to be in place in Mogadishu now after 15 years of civil war.
And after 15 years of civil war, one would think that any effort to establish order is going to be greeted with open arms by most of the people.
Well, that's right. I was able to talk to a number of ordinary people living in Mogadishu, and I tried to find dissenting voices. I tried to find people who are unhappy that the Islamic courts had taken over, that were worried about the road that Mogadishu was going down. And I actually found only two people willing to raise questions. Absolutely everybody else that I spoke to said, no, this is a wonderful thing that's happened. We don't really care what the future holds. For now, we're just happy that the warlords who have kept the city in anarchy for 15 years, we're just happy that they've been kicked out. So I think that the feeling I got was that, yes, there may be problems in the future. People were waiting to see whether there was the Islamic courts might take a more fundamentalist turn, which, in fact, they have done now in the past few days. But for the time being, many people were just happy that the gangsters who had brought misery to their city have been kicked out.
And just before we let them go completely, they presumably have, as I understand it, gone elsewhere in the country to figure out where they go from here. And indeed, they have their supporters as well, including supporters outside the country, and they're talking about coming back.
Well, that's right. I mean, a couple of warlords mysteriously took to sea and may or may not have been picked up by American ships. Others fled north and into central Somalia, looking to maybe rebuild some sort of support among their clans and see if they have a chance of having another look at Mogadishu. So I think although these guys have been kicked out of Mogadishu for the time being, there is a fear that arms are still flooding into Somalia, and the warlords may not have made their last stand just yet.
Let's get listeners involved in the conversation. And again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll begin with Rashid, and Rashid is calling us from St. Paul in Minnesota.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My name is Abdush. I'm from Somalia, and my mom lived down there. And I just talked to her about 20 minutes ago, and she told me how nice it is to be, you know, peaceful finally. And this guy, what's his name? I don't know. We don't know nothing about him because he's just to be a Muslim. We're just jumping to conclusion saying he's a terrorist and stuff like that. But, you know, I don't know.
You're talking about Sheikh Awais.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know nothing about the guy, but I'm just giving him the doubt to see how things go.
Well, Rob Crilly, first, can you help us out? What do we know about Sheikh Awais other than that he was a colonel under the last Somali government some time ago?
Well, we know a few other bits and pieces about him. I mean, he has been a senior figure, probably a leader of an organization called Al-Ittihad, which is generally regarded as an international terrorist organization, which was involved in a number of attacks and fought alongside rebels in southern Ethiopia. Now, this organization may or may not still exist. If it does still exist, probably doesn't have much military capability. So I think there have been links to international terrorism. Now, international terrorism isn't the same thing as Al-Qaeda. He may or may not have had links with Al-Qaeda in the past. There's a suggestion that he's traveled to Afghanistan in the aftermath of the 9/11 strikes. His organization, Al-Ittihad, we think probably organized some demonstrations in support of Afghanistan, just as the Americans were launching strikes against Afghanistan. So we do know he has been involved in terrorism in the region. Whether or not he's linked to Al-Qaeda is another question, but certainly the U.S. Regards him as an international terrorist.
Ken Mankhouse, let me bring you back in and ask you. There are reports that Sheikh Awais is protecting some of the men believed to have been responsible for some of the attacks against American targets in East Africa and the abortive attempt to shoot down an Israeli airliner.
That's correct, and that's why Rashid's question is so important. What we've got is an Islamist movement in Mogadishu that's very broad and does include a lot of good leadership, people who are bringing law and order to the city and people we certainly can work with and want to work with. But there are some hardliners in this movement, and Awais is one of them, and he does have a track record. What Rob was referring to, his older history, allegations that he had links with Al-Qaeda and his leadership in Al-Ittihad are what put him on the list of terror suspects. But that's not really what worries us about him today. What worries us about him today, first and foremost, is that he is accused by the U.S. government, he and some of his colonels, of providing safe haven for several foreign Al-Qaeda suspects. Who were implicated in the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi in 98. That is a problem, and it's not going to go away, and the Somali leadership needs to understand that the U.S. Has a profound interest in this.
Mm-hmm. Rashid, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks, Chair.
Rob Crilly, we're going to let you go as well. We know it's late there in Nairobi. We appreciate your time.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Rob Crilly, a freelance reporter and contributor to the Christian Science Monitor and to the Times of London. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller in. This is Iwuji. Iwuji calling up from Hayworth in California.
Yeah. How are you doing, though?
Very well. Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment about, you know, I don't see the reason why the West, you know, will sit down and watch, you know, white people are being killed in, you know, in Africa, whatever they call themselves, whatever they call Islamic cult or whatever. You know, I think they should go out now and take those guys off. They should go now and uproot them. You know, they shouldn't let them stay more than a week. You know, that's what happened during the Taliban, and Taliban, you know, become, you know, something else. You know, they should go now and take those guys off and let democracy stand, as Bush said it.
Yep, Ken Mankhouse, and I guess that's the fear that this this group in Mogadishu is going to be able to expand its control and establish at the same time a Taliban-like regime in Somalia.
They're going to be worse than Taliban. I'm telling you the truth. The same thing happened in Sudan. Then they left the president. He's still there till today.
Yes,
and they're still going to let these guys still stay there. They're going to be worse than Sudan.
Let's
more than Taliban.
Let's get a response from Ken Mankhouse.
Well, I think that the Taliban scenario, which we have latched on to because this looks superficially like Afghanistan, is misleading. It's very unlikely that we're going to see something akin to a Talibanization of Mogadishu. But we could see a radicalization of this movement. There is a power struggle going on within the Islamists. The hardliners do have control of the militia. They currently have the upper hand. My concern is not that the U.S. should or will go in. I don't think it will. I think the real question is what Ethiopia is going to do. Ethiopia is very nervous. They consider this a mortal enemy. Al-Ittihad is on the terror list because of bombings and assassinations it conducted in Ethiopia in the mid-90s, and it is not at all clear that they're going to sit back and let this happen. And if they go in, what we are going to have is a radicalization of the movement. It's going to conflate Somali nationalism and anti-Ethiopianism and Islamism into a very toxic brew that could get us into a protracted conflict, with Ethiopia potentially ending up in a quagmire there.
And if Ethiopia's interests are deeply engaged, so are those of its former province, Eritrea.
That's correct. Eritrea, which has been, which was at war with Ethiopia, now is in a very tense standoff for the past 7-8 years, is exploiting the situation in Somalia by providing arms to the Islamists as well as to some liberation movements, the OLF and the ONLF. These are anti-Ethiopian government militias that are operating now out of southern Somalia. It's very opportunistic on Eritrea's part, but it makes some Ethiopia even more nervous.
And there are still people in Kenya who have to be nervous about this as well.
Kenya has a very long unpatrolled border as well. It is much less aggressive about protecting its interests than Ethiopia's. I mean, Ethiopia is aggressive to the point of violating international law, I guess you could say politely, but Kenya is very worried. One of the interesting things about the Somali crisis over the past 15 years is that though Somalia has no state, it has had enormous impact on the region, ripple effects in terms of commercial and entrepreneurial activity, ripple effects in terms of fighting and clanism and all kinds of political developments that start in Somalia end up having a magnified impact on its neighbors.
All right, we're going to have to take a short break. Ken Menkhouse, stay with us on the line, if you would. We're going to take more calls when we return. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're going to continue our conversation on what we know about Somalia and what we don't know and how U.S. policy ought to adapt. Our guest is Ken Menkhouse, Associate Professor of Political Science at Davidson College. And if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Yesterday, the U.S. announced it would not have any contact with the new leader of the Islamic courts because he is on a list of terrorists. The announcement does not mark much of a change in U.S. policy towards Somalia, though. For the last decade, U.S. policy has generally been one of neglect. Joining us to talk about this is Ambassador David Shin, ambassador to Ethiopia and a former State Department coordinator for Somalia, and he's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Good to be here, Neil.
And is neglect a reasonable description of U.S. policy?
Yes, it is, and it's a word I think that applies going all the way back to March of 1994 when U.S. troops departed Somalia. And after that departure, there was relatively little interest, certainly at higher levels in the U.S. government. And that has continued pretty much up until the invasion of Afghanistan, at which point there was an uptick in American interest in Somalia, primarily due to counterterrorism reasons. Mm-hmm. But except for that interest, there really hasn't been a great deal.
A force of U.S. Marines is based in Djibouti, and next door to Somalia, or next door to parts of Somalia, a good long way from Mogadishu. But nevertheless, U.S. interest there, other than the military, how did the U.S. get involved in backing these warlords against these Islamic courts?
It may have been, in part, an act of desperation. I think the United States did feel that there were individuals still in Mogadishu who had been involved in these attacks on the American embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam in 1998. They were very anxious to do something about it, capture them ideally, and they used whatever tool they could. And in this case, they relied upon some local warlords who weren't up to the capacity to do that, and I think it backfired.
Critics have said that this was a counterterrorism on the cheap, a short-sighted policy, that the warlords, even if they won, were no particular bargain. Indeed, some said there was a big split between the State Department, which was trying to go slow approach, and the closer-term goals of the Pentagon.
I think there were different points of view in different agencies of the government. I don't think any particular agency was completely unified as to how to proceed with this. The problem with trying to identify a group to do your work for you in Somalia is that any group is going to act in their own interests, and they're going to settle scores that they want to settle, and if someone is going to offer them assets to do that, they'll certainly take advantage of it. And I think that's where the real mistake was made. You can't rely upon any group to do your work for you. You've got to do it yourself.
Indeed. And Ken Mankhouse, let's get you back involved in this. The last experience, as the ambassador has been saying, was back in the in 1994. People, this is best captured in the two words Black Hawk Down, I think, for most people. And these warlords, were these people with whom we had experience in from that period?
We did have experience, in some cases negative. Some of them were fighting against us at the time. And, of course, that just backs up Ambassador Shin's point that you can't count on anyone there. The alliances are very very slippery and often short-term.
Let's get another listener on the line. This is Abdul. Abdul calling from Minneapolis.
Yes, my name is Abdul. I'm calling from Minneapolis. I think that the claim of the Sheikh of his links to Al-Qaeda are coming through from a normal or enemy, which is Ethiopia, which would claim, even if there wasn't Sheikh Shoma, it would claim the Somali state is part of its internal resistance. And my other comment is that I think some of the people are creating drama that does not exist at this point. I think the Sheikh is part of an organization. He's not a charismatic leader, and I think that there should be there is an Islamophobia, that any Islamic organization would turn into some sort of a radical group, or that they don't have any moderate or people that would see the world as a place for everybody, and I think the fear is that thousands and millions of Somalis are now laying their hopes and their future in these areas, that they feel secure now, and it will radicalize them, and it will push them to the limits by putting a black mark on their what they see as their future,
as their leadership. Ambassador Shin, let me ask you, is certainly there has been enmity between Somalia and Ethiopia, but is Abdul right to say that it is this image of Sheikh Owais as a fundamentalist connected to Al-Qaeda is coming from Ethiopia?
Not entirely. The fact is that Sheikh Hassan Dahir Owais was very much involved with Al-Ittihad al-Islami that was talked about earlier. That was an organization that by its own admission carried out attacks inside Ethiopia, including in Addis Ababa, and even at one point claimed that it tried to assassinate one Ethiopian minister. It failed in that. It's also a fact that Hassan Owais was a member of this organization and a very important member. The question then becomes, was he responsible in some way for authorizing or suggesting that these kinds of attacks ought to go forward? They were not aimed at the United States. They were not aimed anywhere other than Ethiopia. But it certainly does link him to a practice which is disturbing. And I think that's what people are concerned about now. And that's information that comes from a variety of sources, not just the Ethiopians.
Sheikh Owais, as we were hearing earlier, was always sort of the power behind the Islamic Courts Union. Nevertheless, he is not the only voice in that organization, and as Abdul says, it is not, by any stretch of the imagination, monolithic.
That's absolutely right. I agree 100% with Ken Mankhouse when he stated earlier that it's a variegated group in the Islamic court structure, and some, I think, are indeed quite moderate. Perhaps a majority are very moderate. The issue is now, who is going to prevail in that organization? It's very decentralized, or at least it was until the last couple of days. It seems to be becoming a little more centralized at the moment. There's a lot that we don't know as to how all of this is going to play out, and that's what's critical. The fact that they would, all of them, would like to create an Islamic State, that's fine. That's Somalia would not be the first state in the Union to be an Islamic State. They're 99% Muslim, after all. So one can understand that. But the question is, what kind of an Islamic State will it be? And will the leadership sever any ties that it might have had with international terrorism?
And
can I make another comment?
Go ahead, if you would.
Yeah, my comment is David Sheen's comment about what would it be about what looking at the future. Yes, we all worry about that, but we should wait and see how things develop. This was not expected. The kick out of the warlords was not something that they were ready for. They would never thought that they would take over the city, that they never thought that they would kick out the warlords and will gain the support of the people the way they have. And this was a dramatic transition, and it will they let them consolidate power, let them come on board. They have invited all the intellectuals of the country. I think what we're looking is not 100% of what maybe the West would describe as an accepted organization, but somewhere that would hold the future for future moderation, for mm-hmm. future transition, and Somalia can easily come back to the world.
Okay,
Somalia can come back to the wall.
Abdul, thank you very much for that, and we'll get responses from our guest, Ambassador Shin. Every indication we're seeing from the State Department, they're certainly not thrilled with Sheikh Owais, but nevertheless, they don't seem to be opposed to the idea of giving this new institution a chance.
That's my read. I think people are moving cautiously, and that's absolutely the right approach. I agree with your listener that one should not jump to conclusions on this. It's still a very fluid, very volatile situation. It could go any number of ways. It could turn out okay if everything goes well. If the extremists do indeed grab control of the organization, then I would be very worried about it. But we don't know that at this point. And this is a time to move carefully and assess the situation and get as much good information as we can get.
Ken Menkhaus, is that your feeling as well? And again, getting that point about information, finding out what's going on, do you believe that the United States has good sources of information inside Somalia?
No, I don't think anyone does. I think the situation is so fluid that even the local actors are in a state of uncertainty and confusion, and that's dangerous because mistakes can be made then. I am not as optimistic as Abdul is. I share his desire to see a solution after 15 years of state collapse, and I think that's a lot of what we're hearing in Somalia is people desperate for some kind of solution. But the fact is, we do have a lot of spoilers in this game within the Islamist movement, some hardliners that don't want to see a government of national unity, some people in the transitional government who don't want to see a government of national unity, possibly Ethiopia. And so I think we need to be prepared for scenarios that are a lot uglier than the ones we're hoping for.
And one thing that we have not talked about throughout this is Somaliland, a sort of a breakaway area of Somalia that wants to be recognized by as its own government, its own independent state. But Ambassador Shin, nobody has, at least not yet.
No, it's interesting. It's been totally left out of the conversation. And quite frankly, I think the Somalilanders are quite happy to be left out of this conversation. They declared their independence from Somalia in 1991. They have not, however, managed to get recognition from any other country. They have established some fairly cordial relations with a number of African countries, but no one has officially recognized them. Somaliland has been generally peaceful, and they've had democratic elections there. So they've done quite well. But they do have one political problem, too, and that is overlapping issues about Puntland and Somaliland and who controls a certain part of Somaliland.
So I'm going to have to end it here because, we could go on for a long time, but the fact is the situation remains to be clarified. Ken Menkhaus, thank you very much for taking time off in your sabbatical. Appreciate you being with us. Ken Menkhaus is an associate professor of political science at Davidson University and joins us today from Uppsala in Sweden. And our thanks, too, to Ambassador David Shin, a former ambassador to Ethiopia, who's joined us here in Studio 3A. And we appreciate your time today as well.
Glad to join you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.